Paul, thank you, and it's great to be here. Please, there's a handout, as Paul kindly mentioned, the other Paul. I've had two attacks on my very identity in the talk this morning. One about you'll see the stick man over there, the diagram, or stick man or lignum wearum, as we like to call him here. Please don't spend the whole talk thinking about whether that was right or not. You don't hate camping. You just have a technology problem. You need a hammock, a bedpan, and a Dutch oven, and you'll be fine. That's all you need. And please keep 1 Corinthians 15 open. We said last night, for those who are here, a little bit about the book of 1 Corinthians. We said that it is a book of problems, that if you were to read the whole letter up to the point that we're starting in, you would see problem after problem after problem, and you'd have heard Paul pushing them very, very hard up to this point. He'd have said, change your sex life, ditch your pride, stop eating meat. He's asking for some very significant, you might want to think which of those three would be for you the most significant life change. He's asking a lot, and there's been odd moments of reasons why they should make those changes, but really not very much. And it is here at the end of the book that we get a whole chapter on why all those changes are not a waste of time. So just look, would you please, at verse 58, which Kate didn't read for us, but verse 58 at the end of the chapter. And this last verse summarizes the whole chapter. Therefore, this is the application, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. So this chapter will tell us why people should bother being Christians if there is all this labor and work involved. Why all the effort of being a Christian is not a waste of time, and why we shouldn't give up. And I think if you were to look at that verse, you'll see there's three or four things in it we're told to do. And this morning section, verses 1 to 19, is about the steadfast and immovable part of that verse, I think. This is how to avoid giving up believing, how to be steadfast and immovable. If you look back down at verse 2, I think we can confirm that. It's about if you hold fast, that's your choice, either hold fast or believe in vain. Believe pointlessly. Believe for a waste. And you'll see that, I don't know if you heard that word again and again, verse 14. Our preaching is in vain. Your faith is in vain. Or verse 17 is the same kind of word, your faith is futile. There is a choice about your Christian life. Will your believing, your profession of Christ, be a waste, be in vain? I imagine that a number of people in this room give the lectures to your children about not wasting their time at school. It may be that there are people in this room who still get those lectures from their mum. Don't waste your life. Get up early, do your work. Imagine looking back at your time at school and thinking that was all a waste of time. Well, Paul is saying a bit more than that here. Imagine being 85 and looking back on your entire Christian life. Maybe you've been to church 9,000 times. Maybe you've been on any number of these weekends and collected all the little soaps and the little shampoos. You've given maybe hundreds of thousands of pounds to church. Maybe you've spent years of your life, if you were to add them all up, one to an end, preparing Bible studies. Imagine looking back on it all and suddenly realizing it was all for nothing. It was all a waste of time. So this first session in 1 Corinthians is to persuade us to stand fast, to hold fast, that our believing is not a waste of time. And you'll see point one, hold fast, for two reasons. First reason, because you stand on Jesus raised. And this is, in a lot of ways, a sort of basic nursery school reminder. He says that, verse 1, I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel. And you need, I think, if you would, to pretend you are a Corinthian, And you need to summon up a very, very large ego, if you could, in order to be a Corinthian properly. They thought they were the best church in the world, the most gifted, the most knowledgeable. They had a very high opinion of themselves. One of the joys, I hope, of moving from working with students, who everyone knows, of course, are young and arrogant and competitive, moving from there to working with the 1030 congregation, who everyone knows, once you, you know, hit my age and older, we are all humble and non-competitive and sensible. But if you could please imagine that you are competitive, just hear the nursery school reminder. I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, in which you stand, and by which you are being saved, if you hold fast to the word I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. How do you feel if you are that arrogant as Corinth? How do you feel about the note of danger in particular? Here's the gospel. It's the one that was preached and that you received. This is the gospel that saves you. So far, just so gently patronizing. If you hold fast, otherwise you believed in vain. I wonder if you were the church in Corinth, how you would feel about that warning. I'm going to tell you the ABC of the gospel, the very basics, because I am worried that you are going to hell. That's how Paul opens this chapter. Members of the super church in Corinth, egos and all your believing would be in vain. And I wonder how you feel about being spoken to like that by the Apostle Paul. I meet a lot of Christians who feel indestructible. I think it is a particular danger of churches like St. Helens, where people arrive and grow enormously in their faith. In their early years at St. Helens, you get so excited by what you didn't know that you now know that you begin to say things like, I just don't think I could ever leave the gospel. I hear certainly younger people at St. Helens say that to me all the time. Paul says it is possible to believe in vain. It's possible for a good start in the faith to be worth nothing. Possible to be in a church like Corinth, but for it all to be useless and empty. And that has been true at every single stage of my Christian life. It's been true among my friends, some of the brightest and best from my teenage years, my student days, from people I meet who are in church work or who trained with me for church work, people even who were leaders with me at St. Helens, going back 13 years I've been around now, who are just not keeping on, who are not holding fast in different ways for different reasons. Good friends, people with leadership responsibilities, people who encouraged me or even kept me going, but didn't hold fast. And Paul's kind of challenge in these verses, the faith that we believe, it is made up of a few things of first importance, verse 3, and our entire faith stands or falls on those things. And to the Corinthians, it is all about the resurrection. That gets massive emphasis here, 10 times as much as the cross, which is not to disagree with what Paul said to us earlier on about the huge central importance of the cross. It's not because Christianity doesn't stand on the cross as well, it's because they had a resurrection problem, is why that is the emphasis in this chapter. And having a resurrection problem is not like having a problem with organ music or guitar music or whatever it might be. Verse 1 says Christianity stands on these events of first importance. You stand on Jesus raised. The resurrection is the gospel we first heard whenever you heard it. It's the gospel we believed. It's the one that saved us. Verse 11, it's the only one that anyone ever really preached. And we took our stand on it. And if it was an Easter Sunday talk, I would illustrate verse 2 like this. I'd say, if Christianity stands on Jesus raised, then can I please have a volunteer, children, to come and stand on this big tall chair? And I would have, you know, the bit one, like one of the stools in the expensive coffee bar in reception. And ideally, you'd have a tiny, tiny child. I once used an infant Bright, so one of Alan and Elspeth Bright's children. This is kind of 12 years ago. Got to stand on the chair, and you know, little Gertrude stands on the chair like Christians stand on the resurrection. And you say, what is happening in Corinth, children, is that someone has grabbed hold of the chair and is shaking it. And you start shaking and kicking the chair. And ideally, Gertrude falls into the sound system, and kind of there's an explosion and a load of sparks, and her hair sets on fire. And you get the point. Christianity stands on the resurrection of Jesus. That's what we're saying. But more than that, people who look just like us fall off. Christianity stands on the resurrection of Jesus, and people who look just like us fall off, and their belief is in vain. So verse 2 is a warning. Hold fast, you are in danger. But my reading of Corinth is that they would be yawning at this point. I haven't noticed anyone yawning yet, though it is only Saturday. But they'd be yawning, they'd be saying, we know this, Paul. There's no danger for us, we know this. Well, there's more boredom to come. Because the very next thing Paul does is take them through the evidence for the resurrection. That's where we're going next. And to try and persuade them that the chair is reliable. They'd be bored. But of course, if you don't happen to have the Corinthian arrogance problem, then these verses will be brilliant. Actually, for people who feel unsure or who doubt their faith, just imagine how terrible it would have been to be part of the church in Corinth and feel anything less than excellent, given the kind of self-reputation of that church. How it would have felt to struggle with doubt while everybody else there pretended to be super spiritual and super knowledgeable. If doubts is you, well, you are spiritually streets ahead of arrogant Corinth, and the next five verses may be for you. So hold fast, B, because Jesus really rose. I wonder what your friends say to you about faith. All of my friends, they talk about blind leaps when they talk about faith. I had a beer with a friend some years ago now who said, I am just not ready to make the leap. He'd done Christianity Explored at St. Helens, and I chatted with him about that, and we went through kind of what do you believe. Well, he was pretty certain that Jesus was God. He thought that pretty much everything in the Bible was true, but he said everybody knows that too much evidence destroys faith. Which really just shows that everybody doesn't understand the first thing about faith. Because the first Christians would have as little patience with that idea as do modern atheists like Richard Dawkins. There's an excellent book on the resurrection, which I've noticed, sadly, is not on the bookstall. It's by a man called Richard Dawkins, and it's called The God Delusion. And it is an excellent book on the resurrection. He doesn't believe in it. Doesn't believe in it, but, and Paul does here, but they are basically doing the same job. There's a section in the God Delusion doing exactly the same job. They both agree that the resurrection is a real kind of event. That's the kind of event that it is. The point of Jesus' resurrection is that it happened in real history and it generated real evidence. Dawkins, he calls it a scientific event. And I think he's exactly right. So did a dead body come back to life? That is a scientific event, he says, and the evidence for it would be scientific type evidence if such evidence existed, he says arrogantly and sarcastically. It's not a sort of weird, floaty, spiritual kind of event, a faithy kind of event. It's not the kind of event where evidence would kill it by denying the faith. It's the kind of event where evidence would lead to faith. Paul agrees absolutely. The gospel writers agree in the most profound way possible by setting out the exact kind of evidence that Richard Dawkins is asking and demanding. And you'll see that in these verses from verses 3 down to 11. Paul wants to establish that Jesus really rose, that he did so objectively and concretely and physically. The evidence he gives, it is all about witnesses. The five verses here, it's a repetitive list of witnesses. Then and then and then and then and last of all. And it's meant to say, here is the evidence. Please count them, if you would. There is Peter and the 12 and more than 500. And there is James and there is me, Paul. And Dawkins' book is a bit dated now, but if you were to read it, he doesn't engage at all with the kind of evidence that Paul gives here, which is a bit unfortunate. If you're kind of were reading Dawkins when he was first starting to write for years and years and years, it would be a book on science with a final chapter where he would kind of kick stupid people and say, let's try and think of an example of stupid people. I know, we'll use Christians. And he'd kick Christians. And The God Delusion was meant to be his book where he would lay out why he had done that all these years, his reasons for being rude to us. And in The God Delusion, he doesn't engage with the kind of evidence that Paul gives here in the slightest. He talks about religious hallucinations, but these cannot be hallucinations. And the size of the list says that, doesn't it? No hallucination was ever seen by so many, so often, in so many different places. And the New Testament repeatedly stresses physical, which we will need tomorrow. Stresses these apparent, they include physical interaction. It's place your finger here and touch me, which is quite disgusting when you actually think about what Jesus has invited them to do there. Or Jesus barbecues fish for his disciples and they eat breakfast. Dawkins, he also suggests the resurrection is maybe based on a misunderstanding by primitive people in the same kind of way that tropical islanders confuse people in helicopters for gods. But again, you look at the list of witnesses, and Paul, he speaks firsthand as a one-time Jewish religious expert. He includes 500 brothers and adds the punch that most of them are still living, which means it's only 20 years later, most of them are still alive. You know these people, you know where they live. You can go and check how primitive they are. You can go and ask them and check their story. And more than all of that, I love the three individuals that Paul highlights most of all. And I recommend this for conversations with friends. He highlights Cephas, or Peter, who was Jesus' best friend, highlights James, who was Jesus' brother, and Paul, who was Jesus' worst enemy. Verse 9, I persecuted the church. And what I like to do is just say, if you could please imagine who those three people would be for you. I don't think we've got anyone here who's here with their brother. We might have. I don't know if we've got anyone here with their worst enemy. I hope, as Paul said, maybe there's a few people here with their best friend. But imagine those three people for you. Your best friend, your brother, and your worst enemy. Now, what would it take to convince that group of three people at the same time that you were God to start worshipping you? I love my brother very much. I have enormous respect for him. He is 13 years older than me. And when I was seven, he was 20 and playing rugby for the army. So I've always had a healthy respect for him. But I am not going to worship him as a god. And yet that is what James did. James and Peter and Paul end up being persecuted for this belief that Jesus was God. I think it would take something like Jesus dying, really and physically, and coming back to life concretely and proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that that was what had really happened. The people on this list, they're not primitive. Jesus, a local man who they knew well, he is killed. He's killed in public by Roman rule, by a people who knew how to kill. He dies, he is buried, and then he lives again. All they actually need to understand is the difference between life and death, how to tell the difference, which they are probably better at than you, unless you happen to be currently practicing in A&E or something like that. People died at home, people died in the home and died younger. The ancient world, it was not predisposed to believe that Jesus came back to life. Before Paul was in Corinth, he was in Athens. And you may know the sermon he gives there. It was the center of the thinking world. And he spoke to them about the resurrection. And they mocked him. I think today's resurrection skepticism is actually very, very like Corinth. in Paul's time. We're not in a worse place than them. But back then, Paul's evidence won the argument. Against a culture that thought the resurrection of dead bodies was absurd, people became Christians across the ancient world. It doesn't happen in a bubble, like a tropical island. Hundreds of people in this list, they live lives that are shaped by a really risen Jesus, which then turns the entire world upside down. And it really is the whole world. At one of Paul's trials, to a Roman court and a Jewish king, Paul says these things were not done in a corner. These events, they are general knowledge that can be relied upon in a court of law. Resurrection belief, it changes the real world, the world of history and culture and practice and archaeology and politics. So here is good proof. If you take witness evidence as worth anything at all, if your friend ever tells you something and you believe them, if you ever read the newspaper and think you know anything at all about the rest of the world, Jesus really rose. Those with doubts can be reassured. The chair is strong. Hold fast. And I want to suggest, please, could we push that all the way through our heads and our imaginations? Paul needs us convinced on the physical resurrection of Jesus for what we're going to do in the next two mornings. So let me try an imagination exercise. I think today something is only real if you can post footage of it on the internet. That's true, isn't it? That's the only way we know things are real. So imagine that you were able to take your smartphone with you with Doctor Who in the TARDIS. They have just about begun to do that in some episodes now. And you were taken back by Doctor Who to a certain tomb on a Sunday morning, something like 1,984 years ago. And you were there and you've got some battery, no signal presumably inside the tomb. But you press the record button and you would have seen Jesus rise. And you would have caught a video of it on camera. And you would be able to come back and post a sort of badly edited version up on YouTube because it really happened. He really rose. It really happened. And I wonder if our culture's skepticism presses in on us, particularly when we read the gospel accounts. I love studying the gospels. I love reading them. I love imagining the Bible stories. So I love putting in the details and the smells and the reactions and the laughs. But I noticed a few years ago that I somehow sort of hesitate with the resurrection stories. And I don't think that is because they are somehow holier or off limits for that. I don't think so at all. They're grilling fish. You know, here are a group of fishermen who've been up all night barbecuing on a beach. I think it is our culture's assumptions. We read and they say, well, not really. That can't really have happened. So as a suggestion, I wonder maybe this afternoon or sometime like that, maybe just read through some of the appearance accounts at the end of the Gospels and ask all the hard questions. Certainly, is it real? Does it add up? Are they faking it? Are they lying? But if you think it really happened, then imagine it as real and physical. Paint the detail and make it smell and move and touch and feel and get the wonder of best friends seeing the first man ever to rise indestructibly from the grave. And that would be very helpful for the next 2 days. Okay, so Jesus really rose. And again, my read of the Corinthians is they would be bored to this point. They're still bored. They're saying, we know this. Again, I don't know whether you are bored. Some of you lead Christianity Explored. You explain this kind of evidence to other people. I've got two recommendations if you want more evidence, two books that are on the bookstall. They're slightly different books. There is this one that was written in 1988. It's just been re-released, which goes through in a sort of courtroom way evidence for the resurrection, for the tomb being empty and so on. It's £3 if you buy one, and it is £5 if you buy five, which I think is slightly suspect maths, but that's so it's designed to be a book that would be good to give away, very helpful book to give away. Then there is this book, which I did actually give away to a non-Christian person who came on Christianity Explored and had detailed questions about the resurrection. And I think I basically just wanted him to shut up and stop ruining the group. So I gave him this, and that was a financial hit because I was pretty sure I was never going to see it again. It is £26, is that right? Which is the same as Amazon, so you could buy this and take it away. And he came back to a Tuesday lunchtime service about 3 years ago and gave me a new copy because he said, I read it so often that it is damaged. And I've become a Christian because of what it says. So this is sort of in detail, resurrection in the ancient world, what Paul says about resurrection, why Paul really means the kind of things. But there's a particularly excellent section on 1 Corinthians 15. So there are two slightly different books. Sorry, you want to know what they're called? This is called the biggest book on the bookstore. It's called The Resurrection of the Son of God by Tom Wright. And again, I think it's that we wouldn't necessarily recommend everything that Tom's written, but that book I think is excellent. This one is called Your Verdict on the Empty Tomb by Val Grieve, if I've pronounced that right. Good. So Corinth is bored. Why are you ending your letter with the basics? Why are you doing this, Paul? We know this. We understand this. We probably, Paul, understand this better than you do, frankly. Because we've noticed you're not quite so spiritually gifted and eloquent and good at this as we are. Then Paul drops the nuclear bomb in verse 12. And Paul says, now, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? And suddenly with that, he has their attention. And I think I just need to explain what they sound, I think, to us like he said the same thing twice. So I think we need to understand what he's saying. They are persuaded that Jesus rose. They believe that Jesus rose. The thing he has been talking about, they are persuaded of. They believe that. But they think that is it. No one else is going to rise from the dead in a physical sense. They believe in life for souls after death. In spiritual life after death. The dead in general, they don't get bodies again. That is just crazy, Paul. That's what they believe. And I think I'll be able to show you that in just a second. And please don't blame them too much until you hear what their culture was like. So imagine, please, that we're at a funeral in Corinth. And from history, we know a little bit about the kind of things they might say at a funeral in Corinth at that time. They'd say things like, his soul has departed, or she has gone to a better place, gone to a place where the soul goes, flying free from this body. Things like, this body was always a prison for him. Or they'd say, you'll meet them again, your friends, beyond the grave. Or, do you see the stars? That's where she belonged all along, and that's where she is now, in heaven. That was a funeral in Corinth, a pagan funeral in Corinth. But doesn't it sound uncannily like British culture now? The soul goes on forever, without a body, free from this kind of life. And the idea that made everybody laugh then, and now, I think, is the thought of your friend after death with a new body. So if you look at the bottom, there's a diagram. It's not a stick man, but it is a diagram, the two boxes at the bottom. And that's my attempt to explain what they believe and what they don't believe. So the box on the left is where the Corinthians think they are. This is what they think about God. So they do not believe that dead Christians get new bodies. That's why that's got an X next to it. They don't believe Christians have new bodies after death, but they do believe everything else in that list. They get a tick for everything else. They believe Jesus, after his death, has a new body. They believe in resurrection for Jesus. They believe that everything else is worthwhile, sins are forgiven, and that there is hope after death. They want to believe in all the nice bits, including a life after death, but without a physical body in the future. And point two, Paul wants to say the trouble with that is that beliefs connect. Beliefs connect, which means actually you have already let go of the faith. And verses 12 to 19, we're not going to have time to plod through them every word, but what he does is he grabs hold of no resurrection from the dead as an idea, dead Christians, and he begins to sort of pull on it like a loose thread in a jumper or something, just to see what comes out connected to that idea. Beliefs connect. and they have already believed in vain. I think it's just like it feels like a very, very small error when you're filling up your car at the petrol station and you reach for the black hose rather than the green one. It's just a tiny mistake, isn't it, about which fuel you put in your car. And it only goes in the back of the car, doesn't it? There's I can't see any reason why that should make a difference to the engine at the front of the car. Well, there is a pipe. I don't know how this works at all, actually. I assume there's a pipe. There's a pipe that connects the back of the car to the front. And wrong fuel means dead car, means you miss the wedding, means you get told off forever by your mum, doesn't it? So in these verses, eight verses, we get two chains of connected logic. I think he does it twice. And the diagram on the right has an arrow for every then in the verses, every logical connection. If X, then necessarily Y. So just quickly follow me down the first one, verse 13. If no resurrection for dead Christians, then Christ has not been raised either. Verse 14, pull further. If Christ isn't raised, then our preaching is in vain. There's our repeated word again. And so is your faith. And verse 15, we lied about God. Then in case they hadn't got it, he does it all again. So verse 16, start again. If the dead are not raised, if dead Christians are not raised, then Christ was not raised. Verse 17, Christ not raised, then your faith is futile and you are still in your sins. And verse 18, those who have fallen asleep have perished. See, they wanted to believe in life after death. They wanted to believe that Christians who die are not lost, but they only believe in a soul life after death, not a resurrection. Resurrection, this is one of the things Tom Wright does so well. Resurrection, that word always means physical body life. That is what the word means. There's a different word for soul life after death. And Paul says you cannot have it both ways. Beliefs connect. Without a physical resurrection for Christians, you lose Jesus, our preaching, your faith, our truthfulness, your forgiveness, and any future for dead Christians. It becomes actually a sick joke to talk about Christians falling asleep. You might just as well put a baby to sleep in the mouth of a lion as put a Christian to sleep in death. And verse 19, if hope in Jesus is only for this life, in other words, if Corinthians, you are right about this, well, then we are of all people most to be pitied. You'd be much, much better off being a happy pagan and living as a non-Christian than this. And we'll come back tomorrow and Monday to why those things work, why you can't have a bodily raised Jesus but only soul survival for Christians. But just for today, do you see the consequences for them? They thought all they were doing was just being a little bit less absurd. They may even have thought what they were doing was something sort of evangelistically helpful. They were bending slightly to their culture, presenting the Christian faith in a way that led them into less trouble with their neighbours and the people around them. But Paul just pulls it all out, says no bodily resurrection for Christians means that actually you have kicked away the chair and you have believed in vain. And it may be, maybe that there's somebody here that this is you explicitly. If you really cannot be doing with the idea of bodies coming back to life, then it may be that these verses are a bit of a kind of punch to the jaw. And I think that's Paul's point. He means to knock you over in verses 1 to 19, so that you listen very hard to verses 20 onwards. You must choose, Paul says. You must choose Christianity with resurrected bodies in the future or vain, futile, empty air. Shockingly, in the Church of England, they did a survey which showed that 40% of clergy are not even doing as well as the Corinthians. So 40% of clergy enter the chain one step further down. They don't even think that Jesus rose physically. They certainly believe in vain. And I think we all know, don't we, people who they come to church maybe because they like Jesus or have a church background, but don't want anything supernatural mixed in with their gods. Don't want anything as sort of weird as bodies in the future. Well, tragically, they believe in vain. I think this chapter is actually very useful. These verses, very useful for anybody investigating Christianity. And here's a kind of starter list, at least, of how much of this crazy stuff do you really have to believe before you can call yourself a Christian? Well, at least verse 3 and verse 4. Need to believe in Jesus' death for sins, his resurrection, and the beliefs that connect closely with that. I guess things like your own sin and the punishment of God that you face without Jesus' death, and a future bodily resurrection for his people, judgment for some and rescue for others. At least those things, though they are brilliant things, as we'll see tomorrow and the day after. And this chapter, it also gives all the evidence someone would need to believe them. And I think the reason this chapter is in some ways frightening, or these verses, this morning's verses, frightening, is that nobody in Corinth intended to give up on Christianity. And they were the number one church in the world. All they did, they just changed one very little small thing. They didn't realize that Christian beliefs connect. It's a kind of case study in how Christians deny Christ by stages. I think nobody ever really means to give up being a Christian. I don't think any of my friends that I mentioned earlier did that. It all started with just one thing that was hard to believe or inconvenient to live by. But the trouble is, beliefs connect, and if you change one bit, you probably end up changing lots and lots and lots. And before too long, you hit one that really matters, and then you get crunch point, and if you keep going, well, then your faith is in vain. And I can think of a friend who was the keenest Christian at university with me, did an inquirer's course with me, became a real best friend through that, and was so keen that when we did Romans, as students, the equivalent of RML Romans, we were told by the person leading it that we should read Romans and also read John Stott's commentary on Romans, which is about 85 times longer than Romans. And we should read the section in advance before each week in the Bible study, which meant kind of 5 pages the first week and some weeks 85 pages or something. And this friend, I guess they expected us just to buy it and park it on our shelves for later. That was the point, I think. But this friend of mine, he did it every single week. Read it through. He was very keen. In his fourth year, there was a girl he fell in love with who was a different sort of Christian. And as he began talking to her about her faith, it became obvious that it would be very painful to say that she wasn't really a Christian. So he gradually adapted the things he believed about Christianity so that she could be a Christian. And then he gradually adapted them some more so that he could be the same kind of Christian that she was. And eventually he was explicitly denying two or three things that I still haven't read John Stott's commentary on Romans, but I'm pretty sure Stott would have said in there were the absolute center of Christianity. He didn't set out. I don't mean to criticize him too much. He didn't set out to do that. I think everything he did was very understandable. And you can see why someone might easily do that. But beliefs connect, and you can very, very easily end up believing in vain. And I don't need Richard Dawkins to tell me that our culture thinks that our beliefs are absurd. And I think we shouldn't be naive about that. Western culture, as we've said this morning, is moving away from the gospel. And if I'm like Corinth, if I'm only prepared to believe things and speak about things that our culture is okay with, well, it won't be very long before I'm dragged behind our culture further and further and further away from the gospel, and I won't be standing on the resurrection. So here's another imagination exercise. I wonder how you think about your future in eternity. If you were to imagine your future in eternity, I wonder how much you think about it in physical terms as opposed to floaty spirit terms. We, a few years ago, had a Jehovah's Witness come to the door. They've learned not to do that now. but came to the door and gave me a leaflet. And the leaflet, it was kind of colourful, as lots of their leaflets are, and it had pictures of lambs and waterfalls and trees. And there was a slogan that says something like, there's going to be a new world and you could live there. And my instant reaction was, come on, who's going to believe that? Look at it with the lambs and the water. And then I thought, oh, hang on. That is what I believe. That is what I believe. A new physical world, and you will live there in your physical body. What sort of faith is it that would carry you through hard times, that would stand and last? What kind of faith is it that would enable you to stay Christian through the death of loved ones? What kind of Christian faith is it that would enable you to keep working and laboring for Jesus over a 50-year period as a Christian? You would need steadfast, immovable faith, which means, well, faith that holds to the evidence, examines it and tests it and thinks it right through. And it would mean faith that is prepared to go where Jesus' teaching leads and all the things that connect to it. And Paul writes, tell them and tell us to hold fast. Jesus really rose, it's true. Your faith is brilliant and your sins really are gone. And when you sit in your armchair in the cheesy Christian nursing home for grace-filled geriatrics at 85 or whatever, you can look forward to falling asleep in death. Can generally think that would be a good thing because we have real hope and we have resurrection bodies to look forward to. Shall I lead us in prayer before I hand over back to Paul? Dear Father God, we praise you for a gospel as preached by Paul that is about the forgiveness of sins in the death of Jesus, that is about a hope beyond the grave, that is about a life now that is not pitiable. And we praise you for the evidence you have given us, left for us, that that hope is secure and certain and grounded in Jesus' physical resurrection and in a life that we will have with him that is the same. And Father, please would you help us to stand firm, to hold fast, and to trust you. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.